Wrestle Me More.
Wrestle Me Pay.
You guys, you won't be able to see this, but maybe I'll put the recording on Twitter or something, but I mean, I'm making my hair go really tall.
How does it stay up? How? Oh, what the hell? How does it stay up?
So magic. Magic.
God.
80s El Divo hair. Is it El Divo or Divo?
Divo.
Hey,
I doubt it is. Are we not men?
Can you do that with your hair, people out there?
It looks,
I can.
You look a little bit now like Jim Bob from Carter USM. Because my screen is a little bit degraded. It's very much like I'm doing an early 90s, well, late 90s web chat with Jim Bob.
And I'm in Japan. I don't know what's going on. What are you doing? Come on, doggy. The dog's just looking at me, wagging her tail. She's interested in Wrestle Me, the patrons. She's a patron subscriber, although she pays us in dog coins, the cryptocurrency that got a bit of a boost this week thanks to some GameStop shenanigans.
I mean, the dog Lola is going to... I mean, of all the episodes to choose, this one actually does have quite a lot of dogs in it.
It's true.
It's done really well.
What do you reckon, Loli? What do you reckon, a junkyard dog? Come on. No. Not getting involved. And then she's off again.
Mm.
She's off to listen to Bruce Pritchard's.
That's because they look like they absolutely stink of like the meat sweats. They are. We are doing the wrestling classic from 1985. We're at the Rosemont Horizon in Illinois, and we're having our fifth match, which is a first round nonsense one. It is a very, very lovely skinny junkyard dog versus the Iron Sheik. Junkyard Dog does a little interview, and he's got such a deep voice. And again, nobody has said to Junkyard Dog, this would be more effective if you spoke a little clearer and a little slower. They just let him go. and that is good enough.
He calls the WWF the Dub Dub. The Dub Dub.
The Dub Dub. I had totally forgotten as well how huge a star Junkyard Dog was at this time in the WWF.
Yeah.
He was on Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling cartoon. There were action figures. You could get little erasers with him on. He was just like, his image was on everything. I've seen like glasses and they've got a cartoon Junkyard Dog on it. There were brilliant t-shirt where it's just his head wearing a sort of like 1970s sort of. Superfly type hair. What's that called? It's like a sort of cap that a ridiculous pimp would wear. Sort of big, soft, floppy, big.
Oh yeah, yeah. But with like a feather in it and stuff. Yeah,
exactly like that. Yeah. There's a picture of him of one of those without the feather in, and he's then got his dog collar on, and then it's a dog's body, and that was the t-shirt they put out. It is such a good design. I think they've started redoing them in their WWE Legends thing now. You can pick one up. And I think it might be the best wrestling shirt of all time. If you didn't know what wrestling was, it is a dog's body with the head of an African-American on. And it would be weird to have to if you didn't know what wrestling was, you didn't know why that was there, you'd go, that looks like a very specifically dehumanizing image to be wearing.
Can I just see the wrestler that was based on? Oh, it's a black man in chains. Right, okay. Yeah. Probably not going to watch that.
Yeah, you did say it was a wrestling shirt. I didn't believe you. Now I found out it is. I'm still not letting you in. I am still not letting you in.
To my birthday party.
Thankfully, what Junkyard Dog has here is they have given him one thing which is absolutely bulletproof, and that is one of the great wrestling entrance songs. Grab them cakes.
Yes.
I don't know what cakes are being grabbed.
No.
I presume it's a bottom, is it?
This Junkyard Dog theme is more prominent than at any other point in any other matches I've seen of Junkyard Dog. And the thing with this is, so I had to Google, and I read that it was an older song that was covered by the WWF and covered by Junkyard Dog. So they replaced the lyrics, the singing with Junkyard Dog. But you'd say that it's actually been written by someone who works for the WWF, I believe.
Yeah, I think it was written by, and I might be slightly wrong here because I didn't check this in advance, but I think it was written by the guy who was the manager of Cyndi Lauper, who was very much involved in the rock and wrestling connection.
Yes.
I think he was a guy called David Wolf. And I think he recorded two songs at this time. One was Jive Soul Bro, but Slick's theme. In fact, I think I may have got it wrong. I was thinking, I believe, of Slick's theme. This could well be an older song.
Well, this is from what I read, it was an older song, an old funk song, and they just replaced the singer with Junkyard Dog.
Great. Great.
And it sounds a little bit like, I'm fairly certain that we're not contradicting any copyright here, because I believe you can't get this version anywhere for obvious reasons, because it's Junkyard Dog singing, for crying out loud. But he just comes across very well in this song. And it's an absolute, hang on. Something's gone wrong. Phil, for 10 seconds, will you, Mark?
I once had sex with...
We're on. Got that kind of very thin.
Well, I'm strutting this dance in my neighborhood. Now everybody's doing it because it feels so good. All you need is a partner that know how to move, and the rest are easy. Right. Just dig the groove. And when you get yourself started, it's hard to stop. Just go for your partners, you know what? And then you G-R-A-B-T-A-G-M-C-A-K-E-S.
Now, he does say you've got to go for your partners, you know what. So yeah. Junkyard Dog. Now, Junkyard Dog used to come to the ring in the pre-television and you know, just arena business. He would come to the ring to Queen's Another One Bites the Dust.
Okay, yeah.
And he's gone, okay, well, let me change the song. Obviously, I can't use that in WWF. And they say, what about one where you, this ass-kicking, great, heroic fan favourite with a dog gimmick, why don't you have a song where you talk about you've invented a dance whereby you tell your partner you're going to grab their you-know-what and then you shout, grab them cakes.
Yeah.
I like it, but is it joined up? Does it
relate?
Another
one bites a cake.
Another one bites your bum. I love the song. It doesn't need to make sense because Junkyard Dog is his own thing. The very fact that he is like, I have the attributes of a dog. I go on all fours and do a headbutt. Dogs don't do headbutts, but it just none of it makes sense. But yeah, it makes perfect sense because Junkyard Dog is unbelievable charisma. He is absolutely unbelievable.
He's been a WrestleMe favourite for a very, very long time, but his actual singing voice sounds a little bit like, I think it's Jordan Peele TV show Key and Peele, where where John Peele is doing an impression of the bloke who sang Ghostbusters, and he's written loads of songs about different films and stuff, like Jumanji and The Constant Gardener and 50 Shades of Grey. Okay, white people, he sounds just like
he really does.
And if you're familiar with the sketch, he really does sound like that.
What's amazing as well is Junkyard Dog, when they got him in the studio, he's made an effort. And you can understand, and he enunciates everything perfectly. When you get him in a room and you go, can we do an interview? He's like, wow. Oh, it's just bizarre. As well with Ghostbusters is 1984, Ghostbusters comes out. That is the year, of course, that wrestling goes massive. If you want the classic guy who was always good at like cashing in on a small regional level, Jerry Lawler, he released his own 7-inch single called Wimp Busters, which was about how he would bust wimps. I mean, it's so fucking idea.
I would say that Ghostbusters got sued for stealing the song from Huey Lewis and the News. Yeah. I seem to recall. Can we use this song? And they go, no. And they go, all right, we're just going to copy this song. And they go, well, you can't do that either. You're not allowed to do that.
There is that funny thing of, you know, that Jerry Lawler will have seen that, you know, they got sued for that. And at no point will he have gone, well, I'm in trouble. I bet he'll have gone, ha, they can't come after me now for Wimp Busters.
They'll never get the shirt off my back, and yeah. I'll wear one. So
you people are as bad as me. So how dare you? How dare you? Good luck finding a copy. I've thrown them all in the river. I'm out on 12 bucks.
There's a lovely moment in the middle of this promo where Junkyard Dog is just like just making this guttural sound that he makes, and he tries to congratulate, I presume, the Chicago Bulls, but he's clearly forgotten the word Bulls, and he goes, oh, like the Chicago is good or something. Yeah. It's so confusing.
At one point, I think, doesn't Vince mean Gene says, oh, and you know, hey, we'll go out on the town. And that's the moment where Junkyard Dog looks at him like, this is a good idea. And he's like, yeah, we're going to go out windy city, we're going to make a windy. The only bit he's interested in is the idea that when all this nonsense is over, he can just go out and get pissed. That's what he looks
like. Yes.
One of the sort of interesting things here is A, how good he looks, B, how seriously they treated him as a big star. And what there's really no sort of like better example of that than the fact that this match is against the Iron Sheik. The Iron Sheik was the man who in December 83, so less than a year ago, was the WWF champion. He was beaten by Hulk Hogan. You know, Sheik didn't do many jobs, and yet here you've got Junkyard Dog pinning him. You get a slight sort of tease of a DQ loss when Sheik pushes the ref, but then they decide, no, let him do a headbutt and then pin him. He is huge. He is, even in the short match, you can see he's not very good at wrestling. He comes off the rope really spectacularly. He sort of like sticks his leg right up like he's sort of like on the moon or something, and he comes off and he just wants everything to look big. And then he goes into a clothesline off the rope, and the clothesline's terrible. It's really bad, and it's just because he's concentrated too much on the bounce. And the second he's done that, he's gone, that went really well. Oh, I forgot there are other bits, you know, and it all just falls apart. He is so delighted. It's so amazing to see how big he is when he comes out, the reaction he gets. Just jaw-dropping. You forget how big he was in 85. You know, funny how I think, you know, the later years of his career where the Wrestling Observer, you know, certainly they labelled him as Junk Food Dog, and his work rate was pretty bad and everything. But you do get the impression that had he been around, you know, 15 years later, he would be protected as a sort of, you know, they'd work out scenarios whereby he wouldn't look bad and he'd be a bigger star. There is a slight sadness, I think, when you see how little Junkyard Dog is referenced as being just like one of the greats. It's only when you see matches like this, you really go, you know, he had it all apart from the ability to wrestle.
Not that important back then. Not that important.
No.
Obviously that,
and overrated today, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. It's only half the picture for my money. Iron Sheik in this one is primo Iron Sheik. Physique.
Really
he looks incredible.
He really does.
Muscle monster.
And he does everything you want. He just, like, you know, is cheating the whole time, shouting at the crowd. I mean, he really is good. It's worth saying, I watched this and I thought this is objectively not a good wrestling card in any way. You know, the actual action you see. But objectively, it's brilliant, the whole thing.
Yeah.
About it transcends the fact that it's not very good and becomes really good because it's just... It's just so fun. It's so fun. Nothing sums that up better than match number 6. Terry Funk versus Moondog Spot. Terry Funk at this point, you know, he's a former NWA world champion. He comes to the WWF and he's got this ready-made gimmick of being a cowboy. And he really doesn't have to do the gimmick because it is just Terry Funk and he's wearing a bit more clobber than he normally would. He's got chaps on and a rope. He immediately sort of says Hulk Hogan is going to lose the belt to Piper, and then he wants a match against Piper for the WWF title. That would have been a complete dream program for me. That would have been great. I actually had a look at it, and I thought, did they ever have a match, Piper and Terry Funk? They both had similar things, and they were great on the mic. They were known for being wild and crazy, although Funk could really go in the ring. Piper less so. But they only ever had one singles match in their entire careers. And Piper won it by count out in 11 minutes. It also happened in the Canadian territory owned Maple Leaf Wrestling by Jack Tunney.
Interesting. So Tunney back.
I can't. It's just incredible that two such big stars of their era, they only had that one match. I presume it was it
so
wasn't
crazy.
Filmed. I will check to see if it was recorded. I would like to see that match. And then Funk gets to spit his tobacco. into the camera.
Oh, disgusting.
They put a pane up so it doesn't go on the expensive camera. But yeah, I wrote that. I wrote it's properly disgusting. It was normally you see that and you just go, well, that was an obvious out. And I looked at that and I went, you foul fucking beast.
Where's that? Who's wiping that down, that piece of perspex?
And he goes up against Moondog Spot. Now, Moondog Spot, as you say, dressed like John Cena, looks looks a bit like Popeye, but with a sort of massive shaggy sheepskin stained with urine over his head. He is, he's got nicotine sort of stained skin and beard and hair. And he is one of the Moondogs. So I would say, out at the English language, I would struggle to find a word I enjoy more than Moondog. I would argue
it's like
Mooncat. Mooncat is brilliant. I prefer how it's written down, but I think Moondog to say is lovely.
Is it kind of like a he's like a Southern Yorkel who's not learned to speak properly because he's very tanned and he's like a junkyard, but he drinks a lot of moonshine.
He's the white junkyard dog, isn't he? Whereas junkyard dog is urban, I suppose. He is from space. He is a white space junkyard dog. I sense you what they are. You're absolutely right. You know, they are these sort of southern. They were a tag team of sort of southern homeless space dog bums, and they carry sort of bones around because they share some characteristics with stray dogs that they are just unwanted sort of feral boys.
Feral boys.
Now,
feral blonde boys.
The name Moondog first appears with the avant-garde electronic street artist Moondog, who was very big in the 50s. He was a musician and he released these absolutely beautiful sort of part jazz, part classical albums in the late 60s. But he was famous because he was a street musician. He performed his work out on the sidewalks. He had a huge beard and he got fed up of people calling him Jesus. And so he began wearing a Viking helmet and he became very famous as this sort of weird sort of out of time, avant-garde pioneer of electronic music. He was also blind. Moondog. He'd been blind since he was 16. So he became quite a cause célèbre. Now, the first Moondog appears about 5 years after the musical Moondog, and he was a guy called Lonnie Mane, and he used the name Moondog Mane in the WWF. And he used that gimmick all over America. He was very famous, but he died in 1978 after he was hit by a car. That's how dogs die, isn't it?
I think one of the Moondogs, when he left W, or he was injured for a match or something, they said that he was hit by the car. One of the actual movies in kayfabe, they actually said that he was chasing a car and he got hit.
That's sort of funny, but for the fact that they would have known that the original Moondog Mane died when he was hit by a car. So 2 years after Moondog Mane died, Moondog Hawkins appeared in the WWF.
Hawkins?
No idea. The man who was Moondog Hawkins was not even called Hawkins, which is sort of funny. I don't know why Moondog Hawkins. What happens though, they say to him, okay, well, we're going to change you now. We're going to put you in a tag team with another man who's going to be another Moondog. And from now on, you're going to be Moondog Rex and Moondog King. So they've got dogs' names, King and Rex. And they start in 1980. They defeated Rick Martel and Tony Garea for the tag team championship. So the Moondogs were WWF tag team champions. As soon as they'd won the belts, Moondog King had to be replaced by Moondog Spot because King was Canadian and he'd been denied entry to the United States, presumably for criminal activity, or maybe fears of rabies. It's so funny how the Moondog story really does sort of lend itself to constantly talking about dog-related issues. So Moondog Rex and Moondog Spot are the tag team champions in 1981, and they defend against people like Bob Backlund, Ivan Putski, Pat Patterson, the Wild Samoans. What happens in this brilliant match that they do is, Moondog Spot is, by this point, 3-4 years away from having been a tag team champion. He is just a face on the cards, filling out the numbers. He's doing a lot of preliminary sort of, you know, work in early matches. And what they do here so brilliantly is they have a simple thing where Terry Funk doesn't want to wrestle him. He says, what's the point? You know, why don't we just walk off and it'll be a draw? and you know, everything will be fine. And so as they walk away to do it, Funk tries to double cross him, and he runs back into the ring to try and beat the count out. And what ends up happening is the Moondog grabs him and manages to get into the ring, and Terry Funk's double cross has backfired and he's counted out of the ring. It was perfect. I would rather watch something like that than a five-star match with Terry Funk. I thought it was so sort of charming. And what it did was it tells you everything you need to know about Funk's character. And what it tells you as well is you can have an audience of people coming to see wrestling up on their feet, delighted, because they loved the way an angle worked and it didn't have to be about performing. I thought it was so fun. So fun. Worth quickly, just while we're here, we'll quickly go through the rest of Moondog Spot's history. In 1987, Moondog Rex was repackaged, so the Moondog sort of died out. Moondog Rex was repackaged as Smash of Demolition, along with Axe. And that version of Demolition had a couple of matches, but all of the fans knew that Demolition Smash was Moondog Rex. And so the first matches of Demolition were ruined by the fans chanting Moondog, Moondog throughout it. A crowd chanting Moondog. It's magical. So that led to them saying to Moondog Rex, right, you're fired. And they brought in Barry Darso to be Demolition Smash. And that team went on to have a really sort of Hall of Fame worthy career. I say Hall of Fame worthy because they were both involved in the concussions lawsuit. So they are not in the Hall of Fame. Rex and Spot carried on as a tag team, as Moondogs. They wrestled together until 1990 in various promotions. And in 1991, Moondog Spot found himself in the USWA, Jerry Lawler's territory in Memphis. He teamed up with a new Moondog called Spike. They won the tag team belts. They then brought in Moondog Cujo, Cujo named after the dog in the Stephen King horror film. They then they were called the new Moondogs then, Spot and Cujo. They also won the tag team belts that they'd lost. And they had Moondog Fifi, who was a woman Moondog.
A lady Moondog. Moondog. I like it.
She'd previously been known as Diane von Hoffman, the Teutonic Terror, and also Lady Beast.
Lady Beast.
Lady Beast. No. And the feud between the Moondogs of Spot and Cujo with Jerry Lawler and Jeff Jarrett of the USWA tag team titles was incredibly, incredibly hot and really well received. And it won the 1992 Feud of the Year in Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine. It was a really, really surprising late career renaissance, considering it's 7 years on from this appearance where he is no good and they don't let him wrestle. The idea that 7 years later he would suddenly become sort of like acclaimed, sort of amazing. He played the role of Moondog Spot from July 1981 until September 1996. Then there was a brief break, and he did it from June to November 2003. So would you like to hear how a Moondog dies?
I must admit, Mark, I'm quite familiar with how Moondog dies, but feel free to let the people who aren't aware of Moondog's oeuvre.
Come with me now to the 29th of November, 2003. Moondog Spot is teaming with his protege, a new one, called Moondog Puppy Love, and they are in a four-team match, a concession stand brawl, on a card to celebrate Jerry Lawler's 54th birthday in Memphis. And during the match, fans saw that Moondog Spot had slumped in the corner of the ring and he wasn't moving. Everybody who was working, who included the Rock and Roll Express, they thought he was selling a weapon shot very convincingly. In actual fact, he had suffered a heart attack in the ring and probably by that point was already dead. Jerry Lawler watched the footage afterwards and he said, "I watched the footage of the match and literally right up until he just slumped over, you'd have never known anything was wrong. It must have been almost like getting shot with a gun because he was fine for the first 5 minutes of the match. And then instantly he just fell back against the ropes in a sitting position." When you say you're fine for the first 5 minutes of the match, it's a thing that you sort of go, I don't know, five is too short. Five is too short. It's like, so, you know, he was fine for the first 10 seconds. You're like, then I'm not sure he was ever fine, but
yeah, no,
fine for the first 5 minutes. Too short.
Yeah, and also, yeah, it just sounds like I'm not getting in trouble for this.
Yeah, completely. No one could have foreseen a 51-year-old man, massively obese with diabetes, doing something physical that he just shut down and we'd all ignore it, that we are in any way culpable for this. when Moondog's partner, Moondog Puppy Love, realised that the very fact that someone called Moondog Puppy Love has to report a death. It's so sad.
What's your real name?
When Moondog Puppy Love realised that his, you know, Moondog Spot wasn't moving, the match went straight to the finish. It wasn't stopped.
I'm glad they finished it. A man literally having a heart attack.
We better wrap this up, lads. He looks dead. The other three teams then left the ring, and the Moondogs, the manager, and the medics stayed there. The audience were asked to stay in their seats, and they were told that this wasn't part of the show. Other wrestlers came out just onto the arena, sort of the ramp, just to see what was going on. Spot was wheeled away on a gurney, and the audience all applauded. And they called an intermission, during which time the audience were told that Moondog Spot was still breathing. They continued the show, and after the main event, they announced that Spot had died.
Wasn't Moondog's wife and child? I think Moondog's kid was in the audience as well.
That is horrible, isn't it?
It's just horrible.
That is horrible.
Absolutely rank.
They then said, "Let's have a 10-bell salute and a minute silence for him." That is an indecently quick turnaround.
Yeah, too soon. Especially from like telling everyone that he was still breathing, and then
I mean, that really is. There's also a thing about, you know, obviously. I mean, you know, it's not an audience's prerogative to know what's going on. And, you know, Jesus Christ, all the wrestlers wouldn't know any better. But there is something about just going, you've enjoyed your main event. Fantastic. And now a little bit of news.
It was all a fallacy. And you just watched a man die.
Everybody here saw essentially a live snuff theatre production. there is a dead man. It happens, you know. It's like Sid James, isn't it? Anyone here in Memphis know Sid James? No. Well, it was exactly like that. there was a lot of criticism afterwards where they were talking about the lack of regulation there is in independent wrestling, where you can just get this sort of old bloke who's been out of the business for a while, stick him in there, have him do loads of physical stuff. And, you know, if you are going to have a heart attack, you know, as Moondog Spot clearly proved, it is best to do it on Jerry Lawler's 54th birthday. I often wonder, is that how you want to go if you're a wrestler? I don't know.
No, I don't think it's. I think surrounded by your family and loved ones, I imagine not.
Probably not being hit with a cookie tray. I think you're probably right. What an idiotic thing for me to even consider.
In front of Jerry Lawler.
Jerry Lawler, I imagine in that intermission, they were just frantically ringing around anywhere that did T-shirt printing. Just going, is there a possibility that with 2 hours you can get us a T-shirt that says Moondog Spot Memorial Show? It just such is the way of the grift. Match number 7, it's Magnificent Morocco with Mr. Fuji versus the Intercontinental Champion Tito Santana. First appearance as a manager for Mr. Fuji here. At this time, Santana, one of the best in-ring performers in the WWF, and he'd had feuds with Greg Valentine, and later he'd have a feud with Randy Macho Man Savage for the Intercontinental belt. And they really were some of the best of that sort of 83, 84, 85 period. I really like Don Morocco. He was a really good turn. He got great heat in the arenas. He was a good promo, and he absolutely could not be asked. I saw a great quote that someone on a comments board had made about him, and they said he's the greatest, laziest wrestler ever, or the laziest, greatest wrestler ever. He is also the most frustrating wrestler ever because you know he could, but he rarely would. And he really didn't. He was famous sort of early in his career. He'd made his name by having these astonishingly brilliant matches against the NWA champion, I think Jack Briscoe at the time. And people knew he could really, really go. But he just developed a style where he went, I will do as little as I need to do to get over. And rather than someone like Ivan Putski, who was doing a small amount and doing it to the best of his ability and winning the crowd over, Morocco had an ability to just go, I will do the bare minimum, and yet somehow people will think it's more than enough. It's a really strange one. He also dumps Santana on the top rope during this match. And again, the ropes being sold as being incredibly dangerous.
Dangerous, yeah, yeah. Very tall.
Almost very destroys violent. Tito. And Muraco yeah. just spends the whole match just beating him up.
Mm. It's a weird one, that one. Muraco at the start sort of tears off his shirt, and it's the sort of shirt I used to wear when we used to work together at XFM, that kind of like bottom of a kind of charity shop bin in America.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a lovely shirt. And he just tears it off. Like no one's just, I don't even think there's like a precautionary little mini tear. You know, like Hulk Hogan always have a little
always
tear
had the mini tear.
To help him get through it. But I don't think Muraco even needed it.
These guys, I mean, they do look like the sort of guys who could like do telephone books in half. You know, I suppose T-shirts are just that sort of... But I sometimes think, like with Hogan, I wonder if Hogan ever, when he's sort of... You know, I know he's a very, very wealthy man, but whether he sort of goes, we shouldn't rip so many T-shirts. I mean, I know I got them at wholesale, and it was like, you know, I had to pay $150 each or whatever. But I mean, over the course of 20 years... I mean, that's a significant amount of money, you know.
And if you went to see Hulk Hogan and he didn't tear a shirt, you'd be annoyed. You'd feel shortchanged. Yeah. He has to do it every time.
Yeah, and then you're just like, you know, this is just a – you might as well have every time someone said hi to him, he has to give him like a dime. You know, this will make up for the, you know, the fact that, you know, I'll meet 15 of you today, and then, you know, that covers the cost of the shirt. You know,
it's like the green powder from like the magical wrestlers and stuff. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of overheads, isn't there? A lot of Jake's got to feed his snake, et cetera, et cetera.
I wonder if you were Hulk Hogan and you were like, oh, shit, I have left my normal T-shirt at home. I do need one of these. And you'd be like, I've got that match tonight. You'd just be, it would ruin the whole day, wouldn't it? You'd just be thinking about it constantly. Oh, maybe I'll borrow one of Muraco's. Oh, no can do. Got to tear that bad boy off. It's a beautiful shirt. But I mean, like that thing about him being lazy, he was a guy from Hawaii, an amateur wrestler as well in his youth. But I think all he really wanted to do was make as much money as possible so he could spend as much time on the beach as possible. And his logo on his T-shirt, unlike anyone else in wrestling, I think it says Magnificent Muraco, and then it's just got a picture of a beach. People used to chant beach bum at him as well. But it's just funny that you sort of go, what's your logo? And you just go, it's a 7-bedroom house in Suffolk. Why is that? And you go, because that's where I'd like to be.
That's the image on the clip art that came up when I loaded up the desktop publishing program, guys. Microsoft Publisher.
Oh, there's a little twist in the end here where Muraco just beats up Santana really badly and then pins him. And Tito Santana manages to get his foot on the rope. The cameraman misses it, but the skeleton ref, who he's back, he realizes it. And he does nothing to get across the fact that the foot is on the rope and the match must continue. Because then Santana quickly pins Muraco and they count the three. And you watch on the replay back, he moves his hands in the hole, that didn't count, carry the match, restart the match. He does it, he sort of just goes, mini, 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 like that. So again, if you were a punter, you wouldn't have seen that. It would have just all been a massive mess. And I thought, this skeleton guy is getting a load wrong here. He's doing a bad job on this. He's frightening looking, and he's not doing all the things he should be doing. But I mean, stay tuned. Stay tuned. It's going to have one of the great ones. There's a very, very small bullshit chant here. And I think I've talked about this before, about what's the earliest bullshit chant. But considering this is the first pay-per-view, I have a feeling this may be one of the earliest bullshit chants, where because the ref doesn't convey the, oh, the foot was on the rope and the match must carry on, half of the crowd just begin going, bullshit, bullshit. Because the ref's fucked it.
That's what tells you. So it's quite important to make sure everyone in the arena knows exactly what's happened.
Yeah, right, stupid skeleton ref. It makes Santana, people just go, why did Santana win? And again, that will come up right at the end. I mean, why are you undercut your heroes? Crazy. Match number 8, which is the final match of the tournament. It's Cowboy Bob Orton of the opening round. Cowboy Bob Orton versus Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. Not a great deal to say here. Bob Orton, the father of Randy. And after WrestleMania 1, Paul Orndorff has become a good guy. It is the first sort of properly heated match that happens. There's a $50,000 bounty on Orndorff's head put on there by Bobby Heenan, who is determined to have him taken out. They bring in Heenan just before this match to an interview. Now, Heenan is not on this show, but he is the first person on it who can actually string two words together.
he's really good. And he's hilarious. He's got a lovely lovely sports jacket, which is beautiful, sort of blue kind of granddad jacket. But he's wearing like a necklace that is so tight. it looks like it's one of those little, because I've got one. What do you call these ones that are like, they're like long kind of
like an ingot
kind of shapes. Ingot. And he's got one of them on, but the chain is just way too short. So it's kind of like, you know, like a lint chocolate bunny. They've got like a little bow around their neck. Yeah. It's like that. And every time he talks, it bobbles around because his neck muscles are making a
bulging.
It's horrible.
He's got also one of those massive gold watches on, and it's when he's talking, undoubtedly it's real. Heenan is not going to be, you know, working at that level for that long and turn up with a hooky watch. I did look at that and I just thought, oh, that is so sort of gaudy and incredible. In the 80s, that would have been just everything, and now you sort of look at it and you go, oh, horrible thing. To own Bobby Heenan's watch. It would just be amazing. Obviously melted down. Again, they have the neck across the ropes for Paul Orndorff, because the ropes are getting the big
incredibly
push in this show. Yes. We see a bit of Orton's bottom, but it's been digitized. Interesting, odd little things that you do notice. And in this show, there are three bits where people grab trunks to sort of show the bum. It happens to Savage, it happens to Orton, and it happens to Piper. Orton's the only one they bother digitizing. But what that slightly is a shift again. It's one of those things you do in an arena and it's really funny, but it's one of those things you cannot put on television.
You can't show on television, yeah.
Advertisers are going to be like, there was male nudity. And so that's one of the things that gets phased out, where it was obviously used a huge amount.
Right. Well, Orton, I guess, he's clearly got a dirty bum. That's why they've kind of mosaiced that out, I suppose. Yeah. Over everyone else's normal clean bums.
Maybe he'd had some kind of weird early robotic cyber sort of stuff.
Cyber
instead
ass.
Of an arse. I want to email my shit to my toilet.
He's got a personalised butt plug that he wants everyone to see. They'll be on sale at the merch stand.
Orndorff is so underrated, I think, at this period. He never had a really good sort of WrestleMania match, but he did get a big match when he eventually turned on Hogan again in 87 at an event called The Big Event. And that's a really, really hot, good match. He was a good opponent for Hogan. He's one of those guys who over time, you know, he never quite so lived up to that main event billing again, and he became quite bitter, I think, about his, you know, having been one of the big early main eventers during the TV sort of WWF expansion years. I think he felt like, you know, he's never got his due. I had a look at his Wikipedia. His middle name is Parlett.
Ooh,
so he is Paul fancy. Parlett Orndorff.
Paul Parlett. It's like a girl. It sounds like Paulette, doesn't it? Paul Paulette.
It sounds like his mum and dad were like, we were going to call, if it was a boy, Paul, a girl, Parlette. And then they were like, Parlette is such a nice name. We've invented it. No one's ever used it before. It's Paul Parlette.
We've already bought the gravestone, for crying out loud. We've got to name him that now. Unbelievable. mate.
Bob Orton obviously is DQ'd for using his cast. He rarely had a match that he didn't get disqualified for using his cast in. Let me make that clear.
He just constantly had a cast on.
Yeah, it was his gimmick that he had an injury, so he had to wrestle in the cast, and he would always use the cast. You know, you can't criticize him. If you've got a gimmick, then you use it. That's how gimmicks get over. There's no point in having a gimmick and not doing it. But it was one of those gimmicks I don't think anyone ever quite enjoyed. It was certainly from an audience perspective, you weren't like, he's done it again. You were like, oh, there we are.
If he doesn't do it, it's Chekhov's gun, isn't it? It's like he's got it and he has to use it, otherwise we'll feel shortchanged, even though the effect is a bit shit.
Exactly. I mean, it is very much, I Chekhov's gun, I now call Orton's cast. Orton's cast is the thing. If there is a cast, it will be used, but the use of the cast will ruin the play. They miss it in the replay. They say, let's have a look at that in the replay, and it's in the wrong place. And so all we get is a slow motion replay of Calbert B. Morton walking away after it's all happened. and credit to Gorilla Monsoon. He's like, oh, yeah, well, we don't have the right bit. I like that.
We are a two-bit operation at this point. My God.
We then get probably the finest, most lasting image of the entire thing for me.
Oh,
which is,
yeah. Look, if we're gonna end a show on anything, it will be this. The camera just cuts. I just laughed so much I pumped. Sorry if anyone heard that, but I just, oh wow. He's just Lord Alfred Hayes. It's just grabbing a woman.
Yeah.
He's grabbing a woman.
But he's sort of pressed against her. it's like a child's idea of what sex is. You go in for a very close, very still cuddle. And he just, because he's shorter than Susan, he's just sort of nestled like a boy against her.
Why are they doing this?
What is it? What are you getting from that, Alfred? What is it? I don't get it. She's slightly sort of like trying to push him away. Jokingly, but she wants to push him away.
And he's methodically just trying to grab her. It's just...
Yeah, he has to tap him to sort of get his attention, like he's just lost in reverie. Oh, my God, he was amazing. He then comes off it, and he's obviously thought too much about what he's going to do in that bit. And then he hasn't thought enough about what he's got when they're going to ask him questions. So they say, well, let's go back to the board. You can see
he's got a massive stonk on me. Yeah. He is so confused. He's so aroused by the whole sketch.
Steamboat had a little more experience. And so he won, he says. And then in comes Terry Funk. The last thing Alfred wanted. Alfred was having a nice sexy cuddle. With an unwilling woman, but at least she wasn't wriggling. she was enduring it stoically. And then in comes Terry Funk, who calls Alfred. He goes, you big-eyed jerk. You big-eyed jerk. Big
eyes. It's such a weird... I don't recall him having particularly big eyes.
No.
Out of all the problems he's got, his big eyes is
You'd
not one of
them. You'd say to him, you horrible, creepy little fucking molester.
Grabbing a woman. Yeah, exactly.
You little British sex pest. You horrible Westminster black-belted creep. You're a bad boy. But no, big-eyed jerk.
Big-eyed fool, big-eyed jerk.
When I saw that happen, I thought, fucking hell, we've been doing this for 3 years. I don't think anyone's contacted us since we started to say, make sure you go and watch the Wrestling Classic for the bit where Alfred hugs the woman weirdly.
It's one of his best and worst bits.
Oh,
it just doesn't make any sense. It's
just
not explained.
Vintage Hayes. Vintage.
They just needed a bit of talking from him. It looks too serious. The camera catches him unawares.
It does.
And he can't.
it's this inexplicable nature of what it is. He's not going, you and me, baby, after the show. He's just too close. I just want to be very close. I want the contact.
And Terry Funk's clearly just been drafted in at the last minute, pushed into the camera, just make it like that was weird.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, cleanse every, like, scorched earth, burn this down, call him a big-eyed fool, and we'll all be talking about that instead of the molestation.
Oh,
unbelievable.
My Lord. It's so weird. And Alfred, you can just see in his face, he's thinking, this is the best job in the world. And you can see on Susan Watkins' face, I am never going to do this job again.
Oh,
I wonder
awful.
If she likes me.
Am I pregnant now? Oh, dear.
Will I have a baby? Will it come out of my back bottom? Thank you, Alfred. Back to the ring. Resume, Pete.
Resume, Mark.
This was a Stakhanov production.